We are continuing our journey through the life of Jesus, and today we come to a most remarkable event. And this event's going to lead us into what we're going to start next week. And next week, by the way, I'll set up at the end of this message, I'm going to set up what comes after this for the next week, so hang tight. We'll get to that at the end, but this is a long one. The story of the day, there's nothing I could do. I've talked to Anthony throughout the week and said, there's just a long story, but it's such a pivotal story. You can't really do anything other than just go through it. And the way we've been telling the life of Jesus for the last year and three quarters now, we're at a pivotal story that we gotta give our attention to, and it's just gonna take us some time, but it's gonna take us where we're going next. So just buckle up, give me a few extra minutes today, because I'm gonna need all of them and a little extra maybe to get through this big story in this long chapter. With all that said, let's dive in. John chapter 11 and beginning with verse 1, it says, a man named Lazarus was sick. He lived in Bethany with his sisters, Mary and Martha. Now we've met, if Mary and Martha sound familiar to you, it's because we met them back in last Christmas break, one of our Sunday services. The Sunday after Christmas and before New Year's, we took off. We had no live service that day. We've done that the last couple of years to give our team a chance to enjoy the holidays and travel. And that Sunday was an online-only service. And if you watched the online service that week after Christmas, we told the story of Mary and Martha. I don't have time to review it all, but I want to review a couple points because it helps us understand the characters today. Mary and Martha and their brother Lazarus, these are wealthy people. They're really well off financially. They live in a little suburban town or village, a little suburb of Jerusalem up in northern Judea. And just in this area, this town of Bethany, this family's wealthy. They have supported Jesus' ministry financially. They've done things for him. They've hosted him when he comes to town for festivals in Jerusalem several times a year. When he would come into Judea for those reasons, they would host him at their house. That's a pretty big house in those days to host Jesus and his disciples. Most people had very small places. They had probably servants helping them. They fed them. They took care of them. They funded his ministry, we think, in other ways from what we've read and understood. Mary and Martha are sisters who are very different girls. They're very different sisters. On the one end, you have Martha, who is a very task-oriented person. Martha's a very task-oriented person. She's action-biased. She gets things done. On the other end, you have Mary, who is a people-oriented person. She focuses on the relational stuff. So Martha, task-oriented, Mary, people-oriented, sisters, different personalities. Like some of you and your siblings are different personalities too, right? And so in the story we saw back in Christmas break of last year, quick reminder, Jesus had come to town with his disciples. They were hosting them at their house. And Martha's doing all the work. She's action-driven. She's checking on the food. Is the accommodations, are the rooms filled? Are the rooms ready? Is the food going? Is everyone on track? And she's hustling about with all the tasks. Mary, being more people-focused, is interested in what Jesus is saying because he's sitting there in the main room talking to his disciples and whoever else is there having conversations, and she don't want to miss out. So she sits right down at his feet and just listens and enjoys the visit. And Martha sees this as she goes back and forth working, and she gets frustrated. At some point, she says out loud to Jesus in front of everybody, Jesus, will you please tell my sister to get up, help us get some work done? Because there's a lot to do. Please tell her to get busy. And Jesus is like, hold on, Martha. You're all bothered by all the work and you're all stressed out, but Mary has chosen to tap into something I'm here. You'll be more meals to host, more activities till the day you die, but I'm only here so many times. I'm here right now. Mary's chosen to take advantage of that. I'm not going to take that from her. I don't think Jesus is mad at Martha. Had Mary publicly griped about Martha, he may have defended her. But he's making a point that he always defends the criticized and the attacked and the marginalized. So Jesus is like, she's doing a good thing. But these are sisters, different personalities, but they're both good girls and they love Jesus. Their brother Lazarus, a good guy, loves Jesus, and they're friends. So in this story today, Lazarus is sick. He and his sisters lived there in that suburb village of Bethany near Jerusalem. Verse 2 tells us that this is the Mary who later poured the expensive perfume on the Lord's feet and wiped them with her hair. You're like, when did that happen? Well, we've not come to that story yet. It says later, right? We're going to get there. But I'll tell you when we're going to get there. This is a great story. It takes place. We're going to tell it on the Sunday before Thanksgiving. And it's a pivotal story because what happens in that story and around that event is going to launch the final end game into motion. You'll see why before Thanksgiving. But today, we're not going to get there yet. But this is Martha and Mary and Lazarus, three siblings in Bethany. It says her brother Lazarus was sick. Verse 3, so the two sisters sent a message to Jesus telling him, Lord, your dear friend is very sick. He's very sick. That very sick means he doesn't have the flu bug. It means deathly sick. It means so seriously sick that these girls are sending messengers out of Judea up into the region of Galilee north of Judea to find wherever Jesus might be to let him know, we got a problem here. Please hurry. Please get here. Your dear friend. I love those words, your dear friend. Because Lazarus and Jesus were close. And I want you to understand that this idea keeps coming up because if we don't understand how important these people are to each other, we'll miss the impact. Imagine how it goes. A family of financial means. They've been on the ground floor of Jesus' ministry, funding it, feeding him, sheltering them, caring for them. They're all friends. Now they need help. Now they're in trouble. And they're like, Jesus, here's the word, help. But look what happens in verse 4. But when Jesus heard about it, he said, Lazarus's sickness will not end in death. No, it happened for the glory of God so that the Son of God will receive glory from this. What a weird statement. His sickness is for the glory of God? Is that a thing? That makes no sense to me. Well, it'll make sense in a little while. But the important thing right now is that Jesus has said, Lazarus' sickness will not end in death. That's good news because everyone here is worried. He's going to die. That's why they sent messengers to tell us to get down there because he's going to die. So if Jesus is saying his sickness will not end in death, crisis averted, good news. Verse number 5 says, so although Jesus loved Martha, Mary, and Lazarus, he stayed where he was for the next 2 days. Those words, although he loved them. He loves them. They're dearest people to him. Again, he calls them dear friends. Jesus cares for everybody, but to call someone your dear friend, that's a special statement. These are very close people to him. But though he loves them, he does not head down there. He stays put. Verse number 7 says, finally, he said to his disciples, let's go back to Judea. Let's leave Galilee, head down to Judea, northern Judea, to Bethany. That's the problem. In fact, the problem is pointed out in the next verse, verse 8. But his disciples objected. Rabbi, they said, only a few days ago, the people in Judea were trying to stone you. Are you going there again? They're like, listen, this is a dangerous move. Now, if you don't remember the backstory, we've been bouncing around from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but Jesus would come down oftentimes to Jerusalem, and John seemed to record those trips more than the others. He'd come down to Jerusalem for festivals, he did that since he was a child. His parents brought him to Jerusalem for holy days. And he would come back as an adult in his ministry, and whenever he was there, it would usually get dicey at some point. Because wherever Jesus went, from Galilee to Judea, the religious community did not agree with him. They did not like him. He didn't play by their system. He didn't do it the way they thought he should do them. The religious leaders thought he was dangerous to their ideas and their power. And so they fought him everywhere. But down in Jerusalem, that's where they ruled supreme. That's their stronghold. That's where he ran into the most criticism. The very last time he was there, if you go back and read, They tried to pick up stones one time when they got mad at something he said. In a fit of sudden rage, they were going to throw him and kill him. And so the disciples are like, we've been staying out of that area, and you want to go back to Judea because of what? They're trying to kill you. Verse number 11, then Jesus said, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep. but now I will go and wake him up. The disciples said, Lord, if he is sleeping, he will soon get better. They're like, I don't understand. You told us earlier, we were afraid he was dying, and then you said his sickness will not end in death. Great news. Now he's sleeping, that means he's probably getting better, like you said. Why would we want to wake him up, especially down someplace where they're trying to kill you? That's kind of just, let's leave him, let him sleep. They thought Jesus meant Lazarus was simply sleeping, but Jesus meant Lazarus had died. Verse 14, so he told them plainly, Lazarus is dead. Hold on, I'm confused. Jesus, didn't you say that Lazarus' sickness would not end in death? Yeah, I'm pretty sure you just said that. Now you're telling us that Lazarus is dead. I mean, hey, nobody gets them all right. No one bats 1,000, right? You swing and you miss sometimes. He meant well, but he died. So that's a bummer. And then Jesus says this, verse 15, and for your sakes, I'm glad I wasn't there. For now you will really believe. Come, let's go see him. Okay, more questions. You're glad you weren't there? He's glad he wasn't there. Can you believe this? He's glad he wasn't there? What are you talking about? He's dead. And you say you're glad you were there for our sakes. How's that good for us? We loved him like you did, Jesus. They're our friends. They take care of us. Why would that be for our sakes that you weren't there? Why would that be for Lazarus' sake that you weren't there? It didn't work out too well for him. What are you even trying to say? And then he says, come, let's go see him. What's there to see? He's dead. And so, Thomas, one of the disciples, verse 16, Thomas, nicknamed the twin, that's an interesting thing, Thomas said to his fellow disciples, let's go too and die with Jesus. I think Thomas was endowed with a spiritual gift of sarcasm. Okay? He's like, oh, goody. Lazarus is dead. They're going to try and kill Jesus. Let's all go die. That's a good time. I doubt this is going to end very well for us. And so, anyhow, they're going to go. Verse 17, when Jesus arrived at Bethany, he was told that Lazarus had already been in his grave for 4 days. Now, think about this. That probably means that with Jesus waiting 2 days from hearing the news, the time it took the people to get up there to tell him the news, the time that it takes them to travel from Galilee down to Jerusalem, he's been gone for a few days. And they didn't bury people lately down there. It's not like it is today, where people die today, and you know you can embalm them with our better technology and embalming techniques. You can embalm them and let them wait several days till all the family comes into town from out of town and have a visitation and a wake, a viewing, and then come to the funeral, right? That's what we do a lot today. In those days, you just if you could afford to try to make them preserved a bit, you would throw some spices and perfumes on them and wrap them in cloths like a mummy and wrap them up inside there and lay their body out and put them in their grave, but they're still going to decompose like everybody. But you didn't have long. So when someone died, you would have them maybe in your house for a few hours depending on what they died of. And if people were close by, they'd come and be there in the presence if you wanted to do that for a few hours, but you buried them pretty quickly. You buried them pretty quickly back then. And the visitation and the get-togethers would happen after their burial in the following days afterwards, kind of opposite of what we do now. And so when Jesus gets to Bethany, Lazarus has been in his grave for 4 days. Now, people were buried different ways. Most people were buried in a coffin placed in the ground. Some people who were poor might be criminals were burned on the pit of the fire pit of the valleys of Hinnom, and just forgotten or if you know whatever. Rich people were sometimes laid to rest in sepulchers or special graves. Lazarus, this is a rich family. They have a cave. They're going to put him inside this thing. It could be a small cave with his body in there and put a stone in front of it. It's a special place to come. It's not just another spot somewhere because they're wealthy. By the way, that's how Jesus would be laid to rest someday. When he dies, a rich man who is his follower begs for his body and lays him in his own similar grave. But Lazarus is laid in a place like that because they can afford that. And he's been there for 4 days when Jesus shows up to Bethany, and Jesus does not go to the house. Jesus comes to the outskirts of the village, the direction of where Lazarus is buried, but he wants the family to see him first. And so someone runs ahead and tells them, Jesus is here. Now, Mary and Martha are in the house grieving. Mary, the people person, has people all around her helping comfort her. Martha's doing what Martha does, taking care of business, because that's how they grieve. Mary grieves with people support. People are helping her feel better and talking about it. Martha wants to do something to stay busy. So she's like, is there hors d'oeuvres out? Is the coffee restocked? I got to do something. And so someone runs into the house and they tell Martha, hey, Jesus is here. He wants to see you. And so Martha quietly leaves the house and goes out of the village and she talks to Jesus privately. We pick up the story in verse number 21. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died. It's a big statement right there. Lord, what she's saying is this. I believe that you have power. I'm complimenting you. You could have done something about this. But she's not only complimenting, she's kind of complaining. If you'd have been here, this wouldn't have happened. Why weren't you here? Why weren't you here? We sent word for you. And by the way, did you even need us to send word to you? You're Jesus. We kind of seen you in action before. If you'd have been here, this was unnecessary. Why weren't you here? It's disappointment. Verse number 22, she says, but even now, I know that God will give you whatever you ask. That's a very strong statement, and I want to explain what she means by that. Some people have argued that she means, she's saying, but even now, I know you can fix the problem, wink, wink. Because we know, if you know the rest of the story, he's about to do something pretty miraculous. People think she means that. That's not what she means. There's a couple reasons why we know that. I'll give you one of them for sake of time. Because when Jesus goes to perform the miracle he's going to perform, you're going to see Martha, when he goes to try to do it, she tries to stop him. No, you can't do that. She doesn't believe that. She's like, what are you doing? That's not what she means here because she doesn't get it. You'll see that in a few minutes. What she means right now is simply this. She's looking at him and she's saying, I'm disappointed that you weren't here. My brother died and you could have stopped it. We've done so much to support you and I'm disappointed that you weren't here. But even in my grief and even in my hurt, even now I still believe it. I still know that God will give you whatever you ask. I'm not losing faith in you in the middle of my grief. See, that's an easy time for us to derail, isn't it? When we go through things and we're like, where's God? I've been trying to be faithful and serve him and do the right thing. Why did this happen? Especially because some people peddle Christianity a way that Jesus did not. They've been taught through Christianity, Christian organizations and churches sometimes that if you will just believe the right thing and have enough faith in God, that you'll be healthy and wealthy and wise and prosperity all around you. Everything's going to go perfectly. And so if you've heard that version of Christianity, you heard a version that Jesus never promoted, and it's one that's going to leave you, if you've ever walked away from faith because of that, things didn't go well, yeah, because we were given the wrong message. We were never told that if you vote for Pedro and vote for Jesus, that all your wildest dreams will come true. That was never the promise. But people sometimes get that in their head that I believe the right stuff is going to go my way. It's going to be perfect. And so, you know, then when it doesn't work out, we're like, well, where was God? But Martha in this moment says the most amazing thing that we could all learn from. She says, I'm disappointed. We have followed you. We've believed in you. We are friends with you. We have supported you. And when we needed you, you weren't here to help us. And I'm disappointed with the outcomes. I'm grieving the loss of my brother. I'm sad. I'm confused perhaps. But even in the middle of all of that, I still know who you are. And I still believe that you get what you want. I have faith. And may God give you and me the same measure of faith that in our disappointments and hurts of life, we say, I don't get it all and I don't have the answers. But God, even with my questions, I still believe in you. Verse 23, Jesus told her, your brother will rise again. Something we would say maybe at a funeral to somebody trying to give them hope. And she says in verse 24, yes, Martha said, he will rise when everyone else rises at the last day. There was a belief amongst many people in that culture from way before Jesus showing up that some believed that this life was it and it was all that you had was now. And others believed that there was a life after death, but some believed it would be long after death that you die and then we all die and then someday in the last day there's a resurrection. And so yes, he'll rise again. That day is coming for us all. Martha says, I believe that. But Jesus, in verse 25, Jesus told her, I am the resurrection and the life. It's a powerful statement. He says, anyone who believes in me will live even after dying. He says, Martha, what you're saying is that someday after we die, there'll be a resurrection of the last day. You misunderstand resurrection. First of all, it's me. I am the resurrection and the life. And folks, I want you to understand, this is the bold, audacious claim of Christianity that we need to understand. If Christianity is presented to us as another religion with great values to live by and a better way to operate in this world, it is. It's got Jesus' teachings are amazing. They're great to follow. But if that's all we think we're getting a hold of, we're missing the message. It's not as another good religious construct. Jesus is saying something that he's calling us to believe. And if you want to know what it's all about today, it's this right here. Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. That's the bottom line. That's what it's all about. Anyone who believes in me, he says, will live even after dying. Live after dying? It makes no sense. You died. You mean life after death? You mean more than just this world in which we're in today? Yes. He goes on in verse 26 and says this, and everyone who lives in me and believes in me will never die. Never, ever die. Well, I mean, you know, he just said you'll live after dying. Your bodies die. In other words, what we see in our earthly eyes with our limited sight, what we know stops to be, and we call it death, but he's saying, actually, you live on. Life after death. I came to give you eternal life. It's not just about here and now. It's not about here and now. Jesus is very clear. He wants his kingdom to come and his will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. We have a job to do that's relevant to this life, not just a dream of a future. But he's clear. My plans for you are beyond what you see in this earthly body. It's life after death, eternal life. Why? Because Jesus said, I am the resurrection, I am the life. And then he makes this statement. He says, do you believe this, Martha? He's saying, Martha, you've believed in me, you've followed me, you've trucked along and you've financed things and you've supported and you've cared, but do you believe this? This is the real call. Are you willing to accept the fact that I'm the resurrection and the life? And Lighthouse Church, I want to say this is the call to us today. The Lord is looking at us and he says to us today, I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live even after dying, and everyone who lives in me and believes in me will never, ever die. Do you believe this, Lighthouse? Do you believe this, individual? Do we believe this? Because this is the call of the gospel. This is the hope that he came to bring. This is the gospel or the good news that Jesus brought us, that there's more than the fallout of our sin and mortality because he took care of it all and conquered death. Do you believe this? Look at verse 27. Yes, Lord, she told him, I have always believed you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one who has come into the world from God. That's a strong statement. I've always believed? Is that even possible? I've always believed? Like since you were crying in the cradle? I mean, what does that mean? I mean, you've always, that seems a little hyperbolous. I was born this way, I was born believing. Is that what she's saying? What she's saying is what everyone says when they say something like that. She's saying, as long as I remember, as long as I've known you, as long as I first met and heard about you, I have believed who you are, and I believe it still now. And so if you say you're the resurrection and the life, then I believe that too. That's what she's saying. Well, then, verse 28, then she went back home. She returned to Mary. Now, Jesus stays outside. Jesus doesn't come into town. He stays out there next to the village. She returns to Mary. She calls Mary aside from the mourners and told her, hey, the teacher is here and wants to see you. Because Mary never left the house. Mary didn't even know what happened. She was so locked into her grief and her people comforting her and everyone talking to her that when Martha, who's doing all the tasks, leaves to see Jesus, no one knows. So Martha comes back and says, Mary, come over here. Jesus is here. He wants to see you. And in verse 29, Mary immediately went out to him. I love verse 30 because of, well, you'll see. It says, Jesus stayed outside the village at the place where Martha met him, 31. When the people who were at the house consoling Mary saw her leave so hastily, they assumed that she was going to Lazarus' grave to weep, and so they followed her there. Did you catch it? Did you see the difference between the sisters again? Not just the story from last Christmas break. You see it again. Mary's got all the people around her. And when she leaves, they're like, where's Mary going? And they follow her. Notice that when Martha left a little earlier, no one followed Martha to see Jesus. Like Martha's all getting things done and they're like, oh, Jesus is here. She leaves the house. No one even notices. She's probably getting something done. She's probably at the store again. Who knows, you know? But when Mary gets up and she's told Jesus is here and she leaves the house, everyone there's like, oh, where's Mary going? Where's Mary going? She must be going to grieve at the grave. Oh, it's a poor girl. She's probably crying. Let's go with her. And they all leave the house and follow her to what ends up being Jesus because that's who she was. They're different girls, right? Martha has a private moment with Jesus, which is beautiful. Mary's going to have a less private one with her entourage. Verse 32 says, when Mary arrived and saw Jesus, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died. That's the exact same thing that Martha said. If only you'd been here, why weren't you here? We sent word for you. We asked for you. Why weren't you? If only you'd been here. Verse 33. When Jesus saw her weeping and saw the other people wailing with her, a deep anger welled up within him, and he was deeply troubled. This verse used to trouble me. Like, what's Jesus deeply angry for? Trouble. I'm going to tell you what I believe this is about. But first of all, I have to tell you, I've heard people give some really bad theology around this idea. Some people have said Jesus was angry at them for weeping over the death of Lazarus. What? Jesus is mad at people for being sad their loved ones die? Where's that theologically? So, well, he's mad at them because they didn't believe that he could raise Lazarus from the dead, and their lack of faith made him angry. And I'm like, what? Jesus never claims one time that he was going to do something like that. By the way, such a resurrection is unprecedented up to this point. Jesus has never done that before, and he does not claim at this point he's going to do it now. Why would anyone even think that? The only two times Jesus has dealt with death on that level so far that we've seen is when a young girl was sick in her house, and he went to her house and told everybody, she's just asleep, she's not really actually dead. And they're like, no, she's dead. He's like, no, look who knows so much. She's just mostly dead. And so he sends them out of the house, brings his disciples, three disciples into the room with her parents, and he raises her up and tells them, don't tell anybody what I just did. She doesn't need the circus around that. Just tell them she was sleeping. And it was until after Jesus died and the disciples wrote this story that they said, yeah, she was dead. The other story was way up north in the village of Nain when a boy had died a few hours earlier was being ushered out to his graveside. Jesus comes by the path, and as they're coming by, he stops, touches the coffin, raises the kid up. Miracle! But it was a few hours and not a few days, and it was way up north, and it was just, there's no reason anyone in the story is expecting Jesus to do something like this, and he hasn't said he would. So to assume that Jesus is mad at them because they're grieving the loss of their loved one is just silly. It doesn't even make sense. The reason Jesus is so upset is because he's grieving. If you've ever gone through grief, if you've ever lost people that you care about, and you've been through the stages of grief, you know that there's a lot of different stages, and they go through some people go through one at a time over a long period of time. Some go through all the stages of grief pretty quickly, and then they'll cycle through them all over again. They can go in different orders for different people. There's no textbook on how we're supposed to grieve. It just happens how it happens. And Jesus is here with people that he has loved. And Lazarus is gone, and he knew, but he sees the family grieving, he watches them crying, and he is grieving himself. And anger wells up. Maybe he's angry at death. Death wrecks so many things for so many people. Maybe he's angry at sin, because sin brings death. Like he's thinking, this was all so unnecessary from the beginning. And he's feeling the raw emotion. He's deeply troubled. Verse 34 says, where have you put him? He asked them. They told him, Lord, come and see. They bring him over to the cave with the stone. They bring him there. And then the shortest verse in the Bible says, then Jesus wept. He wept. If you know what's going to happen next, this almost seems unnecessary. if you know the story, the miracle he's about to do, which is just off the charts, why is he weeping? He can fix this. He's a fixer. There's no reason to be sitting there wasting time on unnecessary emotions. Right? I mean, just fix it. I have a story from my past I don't have time to tell, but it's kind of funny. We just don't have time. But you ever been in a spot where you're like, someone's like, oh, it's so terrible, this problem's so bad, and you're like, stop moaning and just do something about it. Jesus is like literally in a spot where he can do something about the situation, and instead of getting it resolved, he just sits there and weeps. Why? And what's interesting is that it has an impact. Because they expect him to fix it. Before he fixes it, he stops to feel it. Don't miss that now. Before he fixes it, he first feels it. And look at the next verse. Verse 36, the people who were standing nearby said, see how much he loved him. See how much he loved him. All the people around are caught off guard. They're like, I'm used to him solving problems. But look at his tears. He really, see how much he loved him. Because that's how God operates. He doesn't just want to just get to the issue at hand. He wants to care. And so he stopped to care. Because it was personal. For Jesus, this was personal. Can I logic with you for a minute? Jesus wasn't really around death very often. Right? I mean, when Jesus showed up, death didn't seem to win. A lot of people were close to death, he just healed them. But Jesus walked in our shoes throughout his ministry. He could have just showed up at the last minute, said, attention world, God is here, look at me. Sacrifice for sin, resurrection, believe in me, gone. He chose to be born as a baby, live adolescence, live his teenage years, live adult years as a carpenter for many years, starts a ministry later. He experiences hunger like we do. We saw him experience thirst like we do. We saw him experience exhaustion and weariness like we do. We've seen him have joy and sorrow, do good things and people praise him, do good things and people hate him for it. What in the world? We've seen family drama. He's gone through everything that you and I face in this life. He walked through it, and right now he's walking through grief. He sees someone he's loved, and they're dead, and yes, he can fix it, but people still die, and it will be another date down the road. And he sees people he loves next to him, and they're grieving the loss, and he sees it. And he feels, the scriptures tell us later that he's a high priest that knows what we go through because he's been touched with all of the things we experienced in his life. And so when we go to him, he's like, yeah, I get it. I've been there. And so when he weeps, the people are like, wow, see how much he loved him. And I want to say this to you today, whatever you're going through, let me make this clear. Jesus lets his heart break before he heals ours. That's an important thing to understand. He cares about the things that hurt you and me. Here's why. Because sometimes we need to be heard before we're healed. Sometimes we need to be held before we're helped. And for some of us who are fixers, we don't understand that. Just go fix it. I don't want to care about the emotions of it. Just fix it. Some of us are guilty of that. You ever been around and you just wanted someone to feel what you're feeling and they were just trying to fix you? That's frustrating. But I want you to understand that God looks at you and says, I hear you before I heal. I hold you before I help. I care about not just what needs to be done, but how you're doing. And so he wept. And the people were like, see how much he loved him. Verse 37, but some said, this man healed a blind man. Couldn't he have kept Lazarus from dying? Verse 38, Jesus was still angry as he arrived at the tomb. The emotions are still raw. A cave is a cave with a stone rolled across its entrance. Again, wealthy man's grave, got a cave, stones across it, he's inside. And Jesus arrives in that moment. Look what he says in verse 39. Roll the stone aside, Jesus told them. What a weird request. Supposed to go to the graveside, I'm supposed to like lay some flowers down, say a few words, shed a few tears, and go back home, get some hors d'oeuvres. And Jesus is over here saying, roll the stone aside. And Martha is like, whoa. Remember earlier, Martha, the one who believes in Jesus, right? Look what Martha's response to that is. She's like, Martha, the dead man's sister, protested. Lord, he's been dead for 4 days. The smell will be terrible. I used to have the King James translation when I was younger. It says, Lord, he stinketh. That always makes me laugh every time. He stinketh. Some of you have said those words before. Say about your spouse. Lord, he stinketh. But she's like, Lord, roll the stone away. Are you kidding me? The guy's been... I think Martha is like looking at Jesus and she's like, he's emotional. You feel the anger. He's up there. He's like, roll the stone. She's like, calm down. Look, Jesus, I know that you're not used to being around death. It's not your fault. Well, it is your fault because you always heal people. So you don't really know. This is not your normal scene, but let me tell you how it goes amongst us mortals is your body, it's not a good thing. Don't roll the stone away. And Jesus says to her in verse 40, Jesus responded, didn't I tell you that you would see God's glory if you believe? Martha, didn't we have a talk about this? Well, yeah, how that you live after dying in the other place, but that's not what this is. But, you know, Jesus pushed back, so she's like, I guess he's got a plan. They shrug. Verse 41, so they rolled the stone aside. Then Jesus looked up to heaven and said, Father, thank you for hearing me. You always hear me, but I said it out loud for the sake of all these people standing here so that they will believe you sent me. Now, that's the same thing he said to his disciples when they were up in Galilee. For your sake, I'm glad I wasn't there. Now he's saying, for their sake, I'm glad they're here. What's this for your sake talk? In both texts, he says the words, so that you will believe, so that they will believe. What Jesus is about to do right now is going to up the game. It's about to take it to a whole new level. And he's like, listen, I'm doing this because those who are here are about to see what I'm all about, and it's going to change a few things. And so then in verse 43, then Jesus shouted, Lazarus, come out. Again, not the thing you normally say at the gravesite of a person who died and has been buried. Lazarus, come out. And here's the crazy part, and this verse cannot do it justice because it's a verse. And if we would have been there, there's so much going on here. Let's read it. It says, and the dead man came out, his hands and feet bound in grave clothes and his face unwrapped with a headcloth. Can you imagine? They're like, what's Jesus doing? Roll the sword. Say, what? And then out comes Lazarus. They're just standing there watching him all wrapped up from the wrappings after they put the spices and perfumes. And he walks out of his grave and everyone's standing there has their jaws just hanging open. And Jesus is like, hey, unwrap him and let him go, man. You're going to suffocate him and kill him again. Unwrap the guy, right? Let him go. And no one can believe what just happened. It is unprecedented, even for Jesus' ministry. And that's the main part of the story, and we're going to finish up there in just a moment, but I got to go a little further and read what happens after this, because what happens after this is where this takes us. So let's keep reading for a few more. Verse 45 says, many of the people who were with Mary believed in Jesus when they saw this happen. They were like, Mary, we know that you believed in him, but we weren't really sure ourselves all this time, you know, whatever. But after watching that, okay, we're on board. We believe too. I mean, wouldn't that make you believe? I mean, if we all went down to the cemetery in Cedar Lake today and came to a grave someone was recently just been buried in, and one of us said, I command you to come forth. And they came out of the grave, besides being freaked out, we would look at the person who did that and said, I'm listening. What else you got? You know what I'm saying? I mean, everyone there is like, okay, we believe. This put it over the edge for us. Well, not everybody. Verse 46 says, but some went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Some went to tell the religious leaders. Because why would they try and stir up trouble? Why not just believe? But you know what it's like? We know what it's like today. It's the world we live in. People get on the opposite sides of issues. It could be religious issues or theological issues or how church should be done issues. It could be political issues, racial issues, gender issues, all sorts of issues. And we get on the other side of something, an aisle, something on somebody, and we can never give credit to the other side of the aisle. Never. Right? Because we're good, they're bad, we're right, they're wrong. So if something looks good on a different issue than us, we're like, well, there's an explanation for that. They can't be possibly good. So when they don't believe in Jesus and he does this miracle, some of them are like, well, I don't know. It's time to talk to my people about what just happened. And they leave and they tell the religious leaders what happened. And it says in verse number 47 that the leading priests and the Pharisees called the high council together. What are we going to do, they said. They asked each other. This man certainly performs many miraculous signs. Yes, that's, but this is next level. What are we going to do, they said. What do you mean, what are you going to do? How about you celebrate? How about you clap your hands? How about you go visit Lazarus and say, woo, we're on board, we believe too. But they don't want to do that, so what are we going to do? Look what they said in verse 48. They said, if we allow him to go on like this, soon everyone will believe in him. Gasp. Then the Roman army will come and destroy both our temple and our nation. Aha. Aha, that's the problem, isn't it? You see, these religious leaders, they have come comfortable in their positions of power in the system that they were living in. Rome ruled over all that area, including Judea and Galilee, and no one liked that. But these religious leaders, they had an arrangement. They worked with Herod the Great, who was the local leader, and they had their systems, and they had some authority. And though they could complain about the system also benefited them. And if Jesus comes along and everyone starts believing in him and they lose some sway and some influence, who knows? It could ruin everything. Maybe Rome even, and they start going crazy. This is bad news. It can't possibly be good news because it could mess up our good thing. And who cares about someone getting raised from the dead or healed from being sick? Just don't let my life be less enriched. Verse 49, Caiaphas, who was the high priest at the time, said, you don't know what you're talking about, he said. Verse 50, you don't realize it's better for you that one man should die for the people than for the whole nation to be destroyed. Now, what Caiaphas was trying to say is, guys, we need to kill him. It's better that he dies than we all, because the hyperbole, okay, the hyperbole is this. Yeah, people are going to start believing in Jesus, and that's going to usurp the power balance, and then things can happen. You know how we do this with everything in the world? If they get their way, it's going to get worse, and they're going to wreck everything. The other people, they're just going to destroy everything, and so we have to make a big old hairy deal out of everything we don't like. And so if he gets away and people start following him, everything's going to fall apart. They're going to come destroy us, and so we've got to kill him. We got to kill him, or we're all going to be destroyed. That's the kind of hype people get, especially over in issues that they don't align on. This is going to destroy us. We better kill him instead. That's what Caiaphas said. However, the next verse is very interesting, verse 51. He did not say this on his own. As high priest at that time, he was led to prophesy that Jesus would die for the entire nation. And, verse 52, not only for that nation, but to bring together and unite all the children of God scattered around the world. Caiaphas was not trying to make a good biblical prophecy, but he's the high priest, and God uses him in this moment to say something accidentally that was powerful. He was trying to say, we need to kill Jesus so he doesn't get us all killed. What he was said was prophetic. He was saying, it's better that one person dies for all the people than all the people die for themselves. That Jesus came, not in Caiaphas' belief, that Jesus came to die for the sins of the world so that we don't have to die for our own sins. And not just for one nation, for all the people all across the world for whom God created and loved and for whom his son died. And Caiaphas says that without meaning that, but it's what he said. It says in verse number 53, from that time on, the Jewish leaders began to plot Jesus' death. Now, they had tried to kill him before, but usually it was spontaneous anger. Pick up some stones and throw them. Now, it's not spontaneous. They are plotting. They are planning the death of Jesus. Verse 54, as a result, Jesus stopped his public ministry among the people, and he left Jerusalem in the surrounding area, basically. He went to a place near the wilderness, to the village of Ephraim, and he stayed there with his disciples. Jesus walks, you know why? Because the temperature is boiling. People are like, we believe this guy raised the guy from the dead 4 days later. And others are like, he's a problem. And the temperature is escalating. So Jesus says, I'm going to go away while things cool down a little bit. And that brings us to the last couple of verses of the chapter that we're going to look at, which sets us up for what comes after this week. Verse 55. It was now almost time for the Jewish Passover celebration. And many people from all over the country arrived in Jerusalem several days early so they could go through the purification ceremony before Passover began. Just a little context. There were several festivals, but there's three major ones people would travel to Jerusalem for each year. Passover is the big one. We'll discuss it more later. Passover is the big celebration. Passover is their Independence Day. 1,500 years before then, 1,500 years earlier, they were brought out of slavery in Egypt, and they celebrated that Passover. And so people, though the nation had been scattered through captivities and through work opportunities or whatever else, people who had the money would travel back to Jerusalem for Passover every year. And they would arrive early for some of the religious reasons, the purification ceremonies, but not just the religious reasons. You got to get early for the best hotels and the best Airbnbs, you know. You got to fill up the city because it's going to be booming with commerce, and you get there early. So usually Passover was a week-long city-packed celebration culminating at the end of the week. And people are showing up to Jerusalem in this verse. Verse 56. It says, they kept looking for Jesus. But as they stood around in the temple, they said to each other, what do you think? He won't come for Passover, will he? He is the talk of the town, even though he's not there yet. Verse 57 says, meanwhile, the leading priests and Pharisees had publicly ordered that anyone seeing Jesus must report it immediately so they could arrest him. They're like, we won't do it publicly because the people will go crazy, but if we can find him, let's identify him, let's track him down, and let's discreetly arrest him and get rid of him. And that takes us to the end of today's story and sets us up for what comes next. Before I finish up for a couple minutes, I want to just tell you about what comes next. In the weeks to come, we are now entering the final week of the life of Jesus. I say final week, I mean, he obviously rises again from the dead, but we're about to enter this final week that will result in his crucifixion and his resurrection a week later. We're entering that starting next Sunday. And we're going to take that final week and we're going to study several things up until Thanksgiving. And then after Thanksgiving, we're going to take a few weeks off for the holiday season and talk about some other topics during the holiday season. Then, after Christmas, we'll begin the new year by discussing the last day of Jesus' life. I mean the last 24 hours, the evening before to the morning, the last 24 hours of his life. And we're going to start that in the beginning of January. And because we only meet once a week and so much happens in that last day, it's going to take us all the way from January till Easter at the end of March to get through the last 24 hours. And we'll actually be at the resurrection on Easter Sunday, which works out pretty well for us. That was intentional. But we'll start January on the last day. We'll take the last week, and for several weeks until Thanksgiving, we're going to cover the events of that. Starting next week, when Jesus finally arrives in Jerusalem next week, and when he arrives, it's a party. When Jesus arrives, it is a party. I mean, there's a parade, there's people waiting, everyone's going on. It's a whole thing. And so, join us next Sunday. For today, I'm going to close off by remembering what happened with Lazarus. Jesus fixed it. But before Jesus fixed it, he felt it. Before Jesus fixed it, he felt it. And some of you are here today saying, Arlen, it doesn't help me because Jesus isn't walking around today raising up my loved one from the dead. But here's the thing about the story. You do realize, don't you? You do realize Lazarus still died someday. He's not running around 2,000 years later today saying, hey, look what happened to me 2,000 years ago. He died. And Mary and Martha eventually died. It wasn't like a permanent fix. He just gave him a few more years. The point is not, well, where's that for me? The point was this, that Jesus promised, I am the resurrection and the life. And those who believe in me will live even after dying, that there's eternal life for those. And I've come to give it to you. Just accept that. That's the good news. But in today's story, before Jesus fixed that temporary problem then, he stopped and he wept and he felt anger and he felt emotion. Because sometimes we need to be heard before we're healed and held before we're helped. And Jesus stopped to care. And if you're here today and you're going through a lot of tough stuff, you've lost people, you've lost something, maybe your health is failing, maybe you've lost a job, maybe you've lost a relationship, maybe you're disappointed in life, and you're like, I don't understand what's going on and why my journey has taken the turn my journey has taken. It's just so hard. I want to say to you today, God cares, and God can help you through it, and he will. But he's not just there to help you through it. He's there to hurt with you and care for you through it as well. He's not just a fixer, he's a feeler. And what I want you to do today, if you take anything home from this story, besides the fact that if you don't believe the gospel, Jesus says to Martha, says to you, I'm the resurrection and the life. If you believe in me, you'll live even after dying. And everyone who believes and lives in me will never, ever die. Do you believe this? If you don't believe that today, I call you to believe that. Believe the gospel today and let it change your life. If you've already received the gospel, but you're wondering why things have happened or going through tough times, or you will one day, remember the statement that was made earlier in the chapter. And I want you to see how much he loves you. See how much he loves you. See, what happens is this. When we're going through bad times, we get our eyes off of that. We stop seeing that. When we're going through tough times, we tend to look at the problems and say, oh, what am I going to do? This is so big and it's just so overwhelming. What in the world? But if I can just encourage you today to turn your eyes upon Jesus and look full in his wonderful face and see how much he loves you. Because he does. And if we're not careful, we'll think he does it because it's rough. But as the old hymn used to say, does Jesus care when my heart is grieved? Does Jesus care when I've said goodbye? And the answer is, oh yes, he cares. I know he cares. And today, if you forget this in a moment of heartache, I'm calling us today to turn our gaze back at him and see how much he loves you. He'll get you through it. He's faithful. But he cares.